Librem.fm lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Librem.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Librem.fm app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. This week we read The Old Drift by Namwale Sirpel. It's a really long book, so I think we'll probably just get right into it.
Yep.
So The Old Drift by Namwale Sirpel was published by Hogarth in 2019. The book follows the lines of three different families living in Zambia in three different parts. So the first part of the novel is called The Grandmothers, the second is The Mothers, and then the third part is The Children. Each family has a different racial and class background. One family is from Italy and also has Indian ancestry along the line. One is Black African, and the other is what in Zambia they call colored, which I think we probably would just call mixed race in the US. But more specifically, they are of like a Black Zambian African background and a white European background, specifically British. The book is what has sort of been described as in the tradition of homegoing by Yajesi. It's the different generations of these families kind of demonstrate the history of Zambia, or what it was formerly the colony of Rhodesia. And it starts roughly around 1940 with like a brief period in the late 1800s, I think, kind of around like Livingston Stone's dalliances there, but that was much before. And then it goes all the way to what would be the near future now in 2023. So through the stories told, we see colonialism, revolution, a failed space program, and the AIDS crisis, all through a lens that is kind of at once literary and sometimes slightly magical, and in the end, kind of more reminiscent of science fiction. And between the chapters, we also get interstitial appearances from a Greek chorus of mosquitoes who narrate their own history and how it interacts with, but is mostly undisturbed by mankind. If that sounds confusing, it's because we read a almost 600 page book that's doing so much, and it's very hard to condense down into a short paragraph. So we've got a lot to talk about. Where would you like to start with this?
You brought up that it's formatted in a really similar style to Homegoing. And I guess we can start with that. Like, how did that work for you? There was a family tree in the beginning of the book.
Yes.
And I found that to be very helpful.
Yes.
Because I did have the same kind of issue with Homegoing, as I forgot who belongs to who with what family. And there's three families instead of just two.
You know, luckily this time I wasn't so stupid that I didn't realize that there was a map. So that was good for me. like, I keep seeing this brought up, especially regarding like books about different families in different parts of Africa, different countries of Africa. I think this is a fairly popular way to kind of try to tell a story, and like a history is like through one family through many generations. But I have seen recently a lot of them described as like homegoing-esque, which I feel like is, I mean, that's such a fun thing for marketers to do, but it's not necessarily, you know, the most flattering. Not that homegoing isn't good, but it's, I just think it's not fair necessarily to try to rope them all into being the same thing, because I think it's just common in family epics, no matter where they take place.
Yeah.
I don't know how else you organize a book book that has this kind of scope, you know, so that it's chronological and also keeps people together.
Yeah.
I think maybe the most interesting thing is, because I would sort of forget that they existed in there, were the bits about or narrated by the mosquitoes. How did you feel about those?
Yes. I actually really liked those.
Okay.
I kind of was a bit ambivalent about them at the beginning, but I think by the end, they really tied in nicely with the sci-fi stuff that happens at the end with the micro drones. Should we take this moment to say we're just probably going to spoil everything?
Yeah. Well, yes, we will probably have some spoilers, and we'll warn you as we get to like the really, really big ones.
So yeah, I liked it because I did think like at the end it sort of had a good payoff of what the mosquitoes were. But what did you think?
Like I said, I kind of forgot about them. So like sometimes I found them a little bit shocking. I liked the different voice that it took on. It reminded me like a little bit of the way that like the, God, what was that book? What that was like harmless... The Only Harmless Great Thing by Brooke Bolander.
Yeah.
Where like part of it is narrated by elephants in like a collective voice. So I kind of like that because it's interesting. It's not like a technique that you necessarily see used a lot. But sometimes it was jarring for me in this, which is okay.
Yeah.
I will also say, because I can't read anything anymore. And by that, I mean, I can read it. Just I'm finding myself very easily distracted. So I've been aiding my reading with audiobooks. The mosquito chapters or like little parts are narrated by Richard E. Grant in the audiobook. And that's very charming.
I mean, I think it's always cool when audiobooks do like fully different voice people, like fully different people, not just like somebody changing their voice.
Yeah.
When it comes to like the family epics, I think it's fine. How do I want to say this? I don't like think of it as a bad thing that I can't always pay attention to all the characters and I kind of forget who they are. Mm-hmm. This book gets compared to 100 Years of Solitude a lot.
Yeah.
Because they both are, again, huge family trees and a sort of magical realism element to it. But I did think that this book was really heavy on side characters that ended up getting a lot of screen time.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That one, I mean, starting with the beginning with, now is it Sibilla or Sabia? Because I kept saying Sabia, but I don't know Italian, so I don't know if the double L would be the same as in Spanish.
It's a choose your own adventure, whatever we happen to say. And if it's wrong, you can just choose to hear it the correct way. I'm not sure how it's pronounced either. I probably would say Sabia, but I'm not sure about Italian pronunciation.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with Sabia, and I'm sorry to the Italian language if I'm wrong. But her story was, we got so much from grandma and her mom and then the aunt. And well, I guess I will say her beginning I found very boring. I was like, what are we doing in Italy? Who are all these people? What is going on? When are we going to go back to Zambia? And I just didn't really fully understand the point. Like, we got from the perspective of grandma and mom, but they end up really not being that important to Sabia's story in general. Unless I'm like, I don't know. I'm not going anywhere with this thought.
Well, I can see where you're coming from. Like, I like the writing enough that I don't think it bugged me that, like, it was taking a lot of time in those places. But I think you're right. Like, when you kind of zoom back out and look at the overall story, I'm not necessarily sure, like, how useful that all is. And I think in some ways that makes me, again, question, like, what the point of like Sibia or Sibilla's I guess the one thing we haven't mentioned about her so far is that she has, I guess, what you could describe as like this kind of magical version of like an extreme hirsutism, where she has hair growing all over her body and her hair can grow like feet a day. So like even if they cut it, it grows back like incredibly rapidly. So I think that part is still the part that I get really tripped up on, because in a lot of ways that is the most magical and strange element of the whole book. It's the one that doesn't have like any basis to me in like any real life the way that like some of the other more magical elements do. And so I think sometimes when I think about her character specifically, I don't necessarily see it as being part of the same story, but it definitely is. It's just really strange. What did you make of that kind of more magical element of it?
Yeah, I was really confused by it. I don't know the rules. At the beginning, when she's born, it specifically says her mother looks at her hairy face.
Yeah.
Or somebody looks at her hairy face. So I thought she had hair literally growing out of her face.
Yes.
But then as the story goes on and as she's older, it's like when she's finally in Zambia, she's described as being very beautiful.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that people can't be beautiful who have hair on their faces, but that's not generally, I guess, a conventional attractiveness. I'm not sure what she looks like.
Yeah, I think the thing that's confusing about that for me too is that when she runs off with Federico and they run off to Zambia, she is described as like having to shave her face multiple times a day. So like, but then that's like the last time that's necessarily like brought up. So I assume that she's still required to shave her face multiple times a day, and that most people, because she covers her body with like big muumuus and like caftans and stuff so that people can't see the rest of the hair, I would assume that she's continuing to shave her face and that people don't know about the hair on the rest of her body. I'm not really sure. I found that confusing too. And also, I imagine like swelteringly hot to wear a like lot of clothes on top of a lot of hair on your body in a very warm country.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll be honest, I think some of my frustration with her story too came after I finished the book, because I think the ending, when we go into that like futuristic sci-fi kind of thing, I found all of the themes that brought up really fascinating and really interesting, but it was zoomed through so quickly. Mm-hmm. So then I'm like retroactively annoyed at Sabia's story, because I'm like, we spent so much time with this girl like getting wrapped up in her hair, and her hair is her friend, and I don't even know really fully how to process what went on in the dances in that Italian manner. So much time with that and not enough time with the futuristic stuff, which is what just me personally, I found more interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. And also, you know, I mentioned how like there are other quote unquote like magical elements, which actually I don't personally believe that there are, but a lot of the other reviews that I've read about the book would have you believe that another character, Matha, she, after her partner leaves her pregnant and alone, she starts crying and never stops crying for like most of her life. And so that I thought wasn't particularly like magical. Because I think even another character later in the book kind of mentions that like that could be an autoimmune problem. So I thought that was interesting too, because that one felt more like more realistic or something that like somebody could actually be dealing with, as opposed to like hair that grows like literally magically in a way that like I don't think your body can necessarily produce this the stuff to physically create hair that grows like feet a day. So I think I'm really caught up on this right now, and I'm probably sounding like I'm more upset about it than I actually am, but yeah, I found it just kind of confusing.
Yeah, I think the hard part for me to talk about this is overall it's a really good book and it's very entertaining and I enjoyed reading it, but there's just a lot of questions I have and a lot of little things. Like you brought up Matha.
Mm-hmm.
Her whole story I thought was really good and really interesting, but her different phases of her life felt like totally different people.
Yeah.
The Matha of when she was a kid and pretended to be a boy to go to school felt like a completely different person than the one who ends up getting pregnant and then crying nonstop because she doesn't have her boyfriend.
There is a certain level of a lot of the female characters, I think, like exhibiting extremely strong qualities at times, and then what seem like just breaking into being the most fragile creatures who ever existed, which, like, I'm not saying that that's not something that people can do, but I feel like the ways in which that kind of occurred seemed like a little condescending in some ways. Matha, she was so smart, and she was really good in school, and she did all of those things really well. And, like, of course she became interested in, like, the revolution and stuff. We can kind of transition, I think, to this really strange period in history that I think also, because it is real, like, there are characters in the book who existed in real life.
Well, she did.
Yes, she did. These are just, like, fictionalized, you know, accounts of those real people. So she became interested in the revolution, and her teacher, the one who taught her to read and everything, he was a revolutionary and also kind of, I think you could maybe consider him an eccentric. His name was, Namwali Sirpal actually wrote an article about him that I have not completely finished for The New Yorker called "The Zambian Afronaut Who Wanted to Join the Space Race." His name was Edward Mukuka Nkoloso, and he was like partially like a revolutionary group, partially what was called the National Academy of Science, Space Research and Philosophy. And it's hard to say whether or not he really thought that he was going to send people to the moon, but that was like part of the program. And he got a lot of news coverage at a certain point in like around 1964, 65, something like that, about going to the moon. But like, all of the scenes and the information we have about like going to the moon is like he would just like send kids down a hill in a barrel to like simulate anti-gravity. And, you know, he had Matha and she was going to take cats to the moon. And, you know, he was going to shoot the people to the moon using a catapult and different things. So it's like it's a really strange thing that I also don't necessarily know how to talk about, because I don't know how serious he was, and I don't want to like turn him into like a crackpot when he might have just been somebody who is doing something interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought of it, I don't want to say both ways, but I kind of made me think that, I mean, just based purely on the novel, not anything of him in real life, that in the novel he knows that it's not really gonna work,
right?
But he's getting attention and he's possibly even getting money from this.
Yeah,
and so I did like that. It felt like almost like back in ye old internet days where trolls were just like did things for fun, not to like actually make people hate them.
Yes.
That's kind of what it felt like to me, an epic troll on the world.
Yeah. No, and I thought that section was really interesting, but then I got a little annoyed with the way that like Matha's character kind of developed through that. She seemed not necessarily motivated. It was also confusing as to whether or not she believed in the program or the revolution. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this guy leaves her and she's completely wrecked for forever. And I just thought that that didn't really necessarily line up with the person we had been, you know, made to get to know. And so that I found kind of annoying, and it kind of kept going that way, like throughout the book in different ways. Like these women were, I suppose that's true in some ways, like under the patriarchy or whatever, that one guy can kind of destroy your whole life. But it seemed like emotionally they were much more distraught about things than I felt like they really had given any indication than they would be. I don't know.
Yeah, it is weird because then you like look at Matha's daughter, Sylvia, and she, you know, hustles her way to a hair salon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hair salon gets destroyed. And then I guess for the rest of her life, she just has to live off of, I can't even remember his name.
Lee, the doctor.
Yeah. And then when he dies, she completely just like falls apart. And I think it's not so much that these women are falling apart, but that the fact that all of their character development doesn't support them falling apart.
Yes. Yes.
Sylvia had a really hard life and she always had to struggle and she was always able to overcome it. And then it's like, oh, now all of a sudden she can't do that. It just doesn't, it doesn't feel supported by the person that she is.
Yeah. Are there characters that stood out to you that you really liked their stories or, you know, how they were told and what happened or what they did?
Well, Matha, we already talked about. I really did like her story. I did think Agnes's was interesting because I don't know. It was interesting to read from a blind person who just pretty much had to put all of her faith in her husband when they had to leave. So I thought her story was interesting.
Yes. So Agnes is she's a British woman and she goes blind as a teenager. She had a promising tennis career and then that all kind of goes away when she loses her eyesight and she falls in love with a young man who is like staying at her house. That reminded me of Transit of Venus, the way that like that one student was just like living. Mm-hmm. Apparently that's a thing that happens in like British places. I don't know. It's somebody sponsors you, I guess, maybe. Either way. And she falls in love with him, but she doesn't realize that he's black. And then because they cannot be married in the UK, they go to Zambia, where she's told they would be allowed to be married. And then they find out there that they're not allowed to be married either until at the time of the independence. But
yeah, I think her story really was maybe the most, what do I want to say? I don't know, the most interesting for me to read when it comes to how race was viewed in Zambia in this like British colony, former British colony. I'm not sure exactly of the time period. I guess they were just getting independence at the time.
Yeah.
Probably Matha's family and the people surrounding her were the best. Her sister, Nikuka, her story was also very interesting because she was not the clever, super smart girl that Matha was.
Right.
So she had to go a different way and she did end up going to school. Even though she was older than all the other students, she still ended up going. And then that one too, her story, I guess, really showed to me, like when you're talking about women living in patriarchy, that showed to me almost maybe the best example of it because she did everything right. Mm-hmm. She got a job, but yet she still had to rely on a man. She still had to be like the mistress of this like teacher in order to make it.
And that was such a crazy thing where she like, Matha has her daughter and like has her Sylvia, and Sylvia is several years old when Nikuka Cookie decides that she's basically going to steal Sylvia from her sister because her sister can't really take care of her, but Cookie could use her to make her her sugar daddy, I guess, if you want to call him that. I don't know exactly what to call him. Believe that she has had a child with him so that he doesn't leave her. That was like such a wild thing to like kid who's like 6 years old.
In no way do I think Cookie was a good person at all, but her story was just so fascinating because then she was like, to him, she was just like, yeah, I had this kid. I knew you didn't want kids, so I hid this kid from you. And it's just like, you are so smooth. We kind of skipped over the, I guess, kind of prologue.
Oh, yeah.
Type thing where it is Percy Clark, almost like a sort of diary entry.
Yes.
What did you think about that?
I really kind of liked it. Well, first of all, it's been a long time since I've read something that, well, I guess you do with Homecoming, like things that take place like a really long time ago. So I kind of like that voice and I kind of like the setting and the fact that like there is not like the modern conveniences and that sort of thing. It really kind of transports you to a different like time and place, I suppose. He was also a real person. He wrote one of the first very popular guidebooks to Zambia. Probably, I don't know, must have been around the turn of the century, I suppose. I said the late 1800s, but I think it was probably earlier in the 1900s. Yeah, obviously, he sucks. And the whole situation sucks because it's basically the colonization and the early days of colonization of the continent and that particular area of the continent, which would later become Zambia and probably Zimbabwe too. It's complicated, I think, because there's like certain feelings that I have where, like, as a person who wasn't taught history about this period, where I'm like, oh, wouldn't it be exciting to go to a place that nobody has been before, which is like the way that we're kind of trained to think about that time through the fact that we're not educated about it. And then you have to like really stop yourself and think about what like the implications of that are, which colonization and everything. So it was just, it was interesting because it's not a time or a place that I have read much about, I think.
Yeah, it made me think about like so much about statues and monuments. And I mm-hmm. guess in Saginaw, they have a monument that's dedicated to like the first white man to see the Saginaw River or something like that.
Yeah.
And they can't take it down because nobody has money to remove it or move it. And I'm just like, well, how much does a sledgehammer cost? But I think that part was really good because she was able to write in a way that felt very like, here's an adventure story kind of thing. But then at the same time, really kind of show how horribly racist.
Oh, yeah.
It was. The guy was. Well, even though it's like from his perspective, like you can still see it. And I don't know. I haven't read much. Like I haven't read Heart of Darkness or Out of Africa or books like that. So I guess I can't really say that she is like using the same style, but I don't know. It felt very like believable to me that mm-hmm. this could be something Percy Clark wrote.
Yeah. And I think it does the thing where it doesn't like sanitize it in the way that, you know, maybe some more contemporary books written by people who were not affected by the things that happened mm-hmm. through colonization might write about it in a more romantic way. One of the things you were talking about, you know, the first white man showing up or whatever. There's a quote from the book, which is, "History is the word English used for the record of every time a white man encountered something he had never seen and promptly claimed as his own, often renaming it for good measure."
Yeah.
You know, she's got some really clever kind of remarks like that in there that help remind you of what the story actually is. It was interesting because I've been taking a history class right now through the community college, and it's a world history class. And so like basically the week that I started reading the book was the week that I was reading about imperialism in this period and the British and different European countries colonizing Africa. So it coincided with that really well. And I'm not saying that either one of them necessarily obviously makes me a scholar on it, but it was kind of fortuitous because it gave me slightly more context for what was happening in the book too.
I am glad that I read King Leopold's Ghost.
Oh yeah.
Which is mostly about the Congo and what Belgium did to the Congo, but it's really, you know, similar to what was happening all over. And I want to say too, I had never heard of Cecil Rhodes until I took that class with David Alvarez mm-hmm. at GVSU. I mean, I don't know how many years ago that would have been.
Yeah.
Probably 7 or 8 years ago, but it's just interesting. And maybe like I don't remember learning about Rhodes in school.
I don't remember learning anything about the only African history that we got that I know of for certain was Egypt, like ancient Egypt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think same.
Yeah. I really liked this book a lot for kind of giving just like, obviously this book isn't going to teach me the entire complete history of Zambia. I have no delusions about that. But, you know, I really liked the certain things that it was able to bring me about, like, I guess if you want to call it like slice of life stuff. The fact that like, you know, as an American, sometimes it's really easy to think of like other parts of the world as like very homogenized, but like a lot mm-hmm. of different people and a lot of different cultures are also living in different parts of Africa. It was Africa, the continent, and along like the Indian Ocean and stuff on the East Coast was like those were huge trading ports during like the times when people were trading by ship and stuff, you know? So like mm-hmm. they were highly international areas, which is why like I thought Nyla, she's the one of the children, but her family was Italian, and then her mother is Italian and her father is Indian, and he works in like a wig shop in Lusaka. And so yeah, it was cool to see like the ways in which different races kind of coexist in that part of the world too, because it wasn't something that I'd ever really thought about.
I also think that it was really good when it comes to all the history. I can't say that I can tell you exactly all of the political things that went on in Zambia, but I think this was really good in showing how when the lines were drawn with the boundaries of what nation is what nation, there was really no consideration
right
to who was living there, because there's a lot of different ethnic groups and a lot of different tribes, and it just was sort of like, I don't even know how exactly the boundaries were drawn, but like, I didn't realize, I always thought of Rhodesia as just Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
I did not realize that Zambia was part of Rhodesia in that it was Northern Rhodesia.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, that was, I think it showed that really well too, how this wasn't people's choices who actually lived there originally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was somebody else's choice.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think that's also the part that makes me like, you know, I don't want to say too much about like the Zambian space program necessarily, because I think that was used like historically as a reason why, like, you know, white people looking at that and seeing it and maybe not necessarily understanding the motivations, they didn't get what his goal was, right? And so they could look at it and then go like, this was a mistake to allow Zambia to have independence. Like you said, this area, which was just kind of like arbitrarily rounded into one group of people, not taking into account the number of different languages spoken and tribes and cultures and stuff within that, and then kind of like telling them to figure it out on their own.
Yeah. Well, and it just like with how this towards the beginning, the Italians made all of those people move because they wanted to, I don't know what it was.
They built the
dam.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's like Europeans thought that they knew how to colonize Africa and they knew what to do in Africa, and the people living in Africa didn't know.
Right.
And it's so clear that like obviously they were wrong, because they just thought, oh well, these people can just pick up and move to another area of the jungle, and that's not how that works. Or
right.
Or land or whatever it was, it's not how that works. They know where there's good farmland, they know where they should live, plus it's just their land anyways, of
yes.
course.
Yes.
And then I don't know, the Europeans come in and just don't even bother considering this is a different place. Like, you don't know anything about this place.
The threads of all of that are really interesting too, is like you follow it into like the AIDS crisis with like Lionel's story. He's a doctor and he's like working on a vaccine for what is called in the book the virus, but we know it to be AIDS or HIV. And it's really interesting because like as that moves on, you see that like these doctors who are working on it, who are from what I guess would be considered by Westerners like the third world, don't get like the funding, and they don't have mm-hmm. the same resources for research and all of that thing and those things. And then like also their ideas get stolen, and you know, intellectual property is taken in order to like create vaccines and stuff that then get tested in Africa first. And it's like this new kind of like generation of colonization, just in a different way. And you can kind of see it like repeating itself. I thought that was really yeah. clever. I don't know if that's necessarily something that happened historically. I wouldn't be surprised, I suppose. But yeah. I think it's a really interesting way to keep exploring those same themes.
Yeah. And I mean, even if that exact thing didn't happen historically, like you said, that's Africa's used as a testing ground. And then it leads into, well, this is why people aren't going to necessarily trust, you know, Doctors Without Borders coming in and telling mm-hmm. them what to do and that they're sick or whatnot, because there's a history that they have and that they know and that they've, you know, told through generations that you can't trust people because they will test on you medically.
Anyway, should we move into the science fiction-y aspects of it? We kind of got
yes,
close there.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's really two big science fiction elements, right? There's this thing called digital beads.
Yes.
And it's some sort of implant that goes into your hand. And there's a little bead or beads. I can't remember, on your finger, and then it turns your hand into a smartphone.
Yes.
And then there's micro drones, which are what? I guess they end up being the size of a mosquito?
Yeah. Yep. Jacob, who is the son of Sylvia. No, Joseph is the son of Sylvia. Mm-hmm. No, Jacob is.
No, Jacob is the son of yes. Sylvia. I did like his story, too, yes. a lot.
Yeah, so Jacob is the son of Sylvia, and he's kind of like this young, scrappy, you know, like they're pretty poor, and he is very interested in electronics and that sort of thing, and so he basically like ends up inventing this these drones through like from like all of the e-waste, because Zambia becomes like a place where the first world sends all of their electronic stuff to quote unquote be recycled, but it's technically just kind of a dump. But he uses it to his advantage in order to like create new things and that sort of thing, which I think is like, you know, interesting and resourceful, and I really like that kind of story. But then the drones he ends up selling to this general, and they get used for more nefarious purposes, of course.
I thought that whole plot line was interesting because, you know, as we see in countries with, what do I want to say, I guess dictatorships or fascism, I don't really know exactly the political term to use, but they use the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can shut off the internet, block parts of the internet from the populace, and is a way to control them. And this is the same thing, is right. They're able to use the internet in a way to control their people. I don't fully know what to make of the ending. Like I said before, I thought all of those ideas were really, really good, but the ending happened so fast, and we get the introduction of two other characters that are there because one hacks and one owns a boat.
Yeah. It really is like, it suffers a little bit from those problems that like some really, really long books do, where it's like, ooh, I'm at 500 pages or whatever. And then a whole lot of stuff happens like very, very fast. And in a way that I don't think is necessarily like as carefully crafted as the rest of the book is. So, yeah, that did get a little goofy. I liked the stuff about, you know, them planning this big protest, although I don't understand necessarily why they didn't know what the protest was for. They just decided to plan a protest.
Mm-hmm.
That I found weird, but like I thought it was like really cool and creepy when like all of the drones were deployed at the protest, though, because like everybody was yeah. out, and then they were like, this giant thing comes down and then releases all of these tiny drones, and like everyone is just completely merciless to being like attacked by them, essentially, which is mm-hmm. like an iconic kind of visual, I think, for like a science fiction kind of aspect, which was cool to see in this book that was otherwise very kind of straightforward, except for a lady that maybe looks like Cousin It.
Yeah, that's sort of the same thing of, I thought that was really cool. And the beads, this hand turning into the smartphone, I just think that was like a really, I don't know, like forward thinking thing that could actually happen someday. Like people are getting microchipped to get into their houses, you know. We mm-hmm. had the Google Glass thing a few years ago that didn't seem to really pan out. I don't know, just a really interesting and brilliant idea,
very Black Mirror-y, you know, like these yes. are all things that are kind of like concerns that are kind of futurology related, sort of, about whether like surveillance and that sort of thing. Which I always think is really interesting.
I think the dialogue throughout the book was really good. But then once we get to like Nyla and her friend Tabitha, especially, the dialogue comes off as very like, how do you do, fellow kids? You
yes.
know?
Yeah. I agree with that.
I love the fact that she decided to do this big family epic with a, you know, almost like historical drama, and then go beyond just coming, bringing it to present day to go into the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the future part could have been its own separate book. And I think I would have preferred it to be its own separate book because I really liked it. It just didn't feel, it felt so jarring.
yeah,
to switch to that.
Yeah, I think if there was, I'm not going to fix this book or whatever, but I think for me personally, right, if like some of these elements had been introduced a little bit sooner, it would have felt more seamless. And then, yeah, for like there, you know, the ending was incredibly abrupt. And also the like the event that happens at the end of the book is incredibly catastrophic. I would think that an event like that would potentially kill thousands. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
if I'm well, I guess maybe the dam wasn't exploded, right? Maybe it was just breached, like water was just coming over the top of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe not, but I don't know. Like, yeah, it was very shocking, and then to have kind of no resolution of that was a little bit of a letdown, I think.
Letdown. Yeah. Yeah. I did read in a review where the last section was actually a reworking of the last chapter of Heart of Darkness, I think.
Oh, okay.
I haven't read, like I said, I haven't read Heart of Darkness, so it didn't, I couldn't get that. It just did feel, it felt very much like, okay, gotta tie up all these threads and everything was fine and we're done.
Yeah. I think I did read Heart of Darkness. But I also don't remember it. So it might be one that I halfway read and then just studied enough about in order to answer some essay questions for a class I took.
Yeah.
So that, I guess, is on me being a dummy and not quite understanding. So I'm not gonna judge that. Yeah. I don't know. It overall, like, such an interesting, I don't know, approach to this type of story. Yeah. It's so much and it's so hard to talk about. And I feel like I did probably dwell a little bit too much on stuff that, like, I found confusing.
I want to say, I think it was very ambitious in its scope, and I think it accomplished it. When you have a book of this size, of course, I think there's always going to be, like, things that you don't love.
Right.
But in general, I think it absolutely, you know, accomplished what it set out to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Insane that it's the first book she wrote.
I also read that some of the characters were originally short stories, and she kind of put them together, which, okay, I also think makes a lot of sense, too. And reading it like that, I like the idea of, you know, realizing that I sort of read maybe a collection of short stories that all kind of tied together.
Yeah. Too. And that's, I mean, ultimately, that's what these types of books end up feeling like anyway. Because, like, you have to end the section about that person at some point, so it does have that sort of feeling, because there's threads that follow through the whole thing, but it's not like a single character's arc, and so you kind of miss out on that a little bit. I'm thinking maybe like a little bit worn out on this type of narrative for the time being, which isn't to say that I don't, yeah, like it, because I think it is good, and I think it absolutely, like, serves the purpose and works for what it's trying to do. It's just, I think I'm missing the more traditional narrative of one person straight through at the moment.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think we've read a lot of these. We've read Homegoing, we read Hurricane Season, which is the same.
Oh, yep.
And, you know, I would have said, you know, maybe a few months ago, I love family epics, they're my favorite. And now I'm like, okay, cool. I've done a lot of family epics lately. I think I need a slight break, but yeah. Yeah.
All of those things are good and fine. Yeah.
Yeah. All in, what's the word? Moderation.
Right.
All in moderation. We did a segment, like, I don't know, a year, 2 years ago, that we called Words is Cool. So I wanted to bring that back with the word Muzungu or Bazungu. So Muzungu is from the Bantu language. It literally translates as one who moves around. It was used to describe Europeans who traveled to the African Great Lakes region, which is where the Bantu language is from, most likely because, obviously, like we talked about, the white people were running around, quote unquote, discovering things.
Right. Yeah.
Nowadays, it refers to white people from North America, Europe, or Australia, and in some regions, just to any foreigners. The countries where Muzungu is used are Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Comoros, Mayotte, Northern Madagascar, Zimbabwe, and of course, Zambia. I double-checked with a Spanish-speaking friend of mine, and it's pretty much the same way. If you're from the U.S., I think you've probably heard the word gringo or gringa. It's mm-hmm. kind of the same thing. It just means like a white person, mostly. And it's not negative in any way. It's just a descriptor.
Right.
According to Wikipedia, 30% of Africa, which would be 5% of the world, speak a language from the Bantu family. So it's a really, really big language. And there are hundreds of languages within the Bantu family.
I was going to say it's got to be really diverse too within there. Yeah.
Yes. And I think it's sort of one of those things where I think the definition of language versus dialect is like kind of fluid, and it kind of right. depends on what you think. Mm-hmm. So there could be even more than that if you're going to take, if you know, depending on what you think is a language and what you think is a dialect. But I wanted to bring up Muzungu specifically because I didn't realize until halfway through the book that Muzungu and Bazungu weren't synonyms.
Okay.
But Bazungu was a plural of Muzungu.
Oh, okay.
Because in English, obviously, we're very used to plurals being suffixes, child, children.
Right.
You know, human, humans, add an S. But in Bemba, which is one of the languages featured in the novel, the nouns for people and some inanimate objects, it's a prefix. So for singular, it would be MU, MW, or just M. And then the plural is also a prefix, and it's BA or BA. So Muntu is human, and Bantu is humans. Muzungu is white person, and Bazungu are white people.
Really cool.
I don't think I can think of any word in English that is like that. I'm pretty sure it's always yeah. suffixes.
Yeah,
and much. I think Spanish is probably the same. Probably a lot of European languages are the same. Yeah. I don't really know for yeah. sure. I'm not a linguist, but I don't know. I just thought it was cool. I've never heard of using a prefix for plural. And yeah, it's kind of fun.
Language is really cool. I just think it's so crazy how we all across the planet at like different times and in different periods and stuff like developed ways to communicate, and like there's these rules in which it works, and like some of the rules are similar like across different languages and stuff, and some of them are very different, like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like super different or anything, it's just switching it from the end to the beginning. But I also just think it's fascinating that like children can learn it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's so. I was listening to something recently where they were talking about like there's a point when we're like babies and toddlers, like they get to this point where maybe they learn like a few words here and there until they get like a vocabulary of like 100. But then there's a point where like the language just like literally explodes, and they don't have to be taught the rules of the language. They just like absorb it. And that's so crazy to me. Yeah. Languages are really incredible. So yeah. Yes, words is cool.
I wish I would have taken more linguistics classes in college, but it is really interesting.
Just saw some article, and I don't remember what it was that they said they could do. Like they could, they're working on something that can like stimulate a specific part of your brain and would like make learning languages easier in later in life. And I was like, you know what? I'm not really interested in any early trials for like anything else, but I'd do that. I'd let you fuck with my brain.
Yeah,
if it means I can learn more languages, because I didn't do a very good job when I had the chance. Yeah.
More than that, I need something to help me move my mouth and my tongue in the correct position for pronouncing words in other language correctly. I mean, how many semesters of Spanish I took and I still cannot trill my R's.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have a problem.
I know. But it's also, I'm like afraid to look dumb. I never know if it's like a good idea for me to attempt the accent, I guess, if you will, and like do it wrong and look like a pretentious asshole, or if it's better for me to just like say it the way that an idiot American would say it so that everyone knows that I'm just an idiot American. I don't know.
I
never know.
Yeah. I know. That's the problem.
Anyway, we love you. If you can speak multiple languages, you are an absolute queen.
Uh,
All right. Well, thank you for listening to The Bookstore.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. As always, thank you to all of our patrons. We love you. And also anybody who reviews us, preferably favorably. But, you know, any review is good, I guess.
We can't stop you either way. Whatever. Yeah. You can also find all of the ways you can contact us, email, social media, and our phone line are all at thebookstorepodcast.com. It's our anniversary. If you want to call us and just like say anything or even ask whatever random question you would like, we would love to get a phone call from you. So check that out. Bookstorepodcast.com.
So we had a poll up on our Patreon about what our next read would be. I think we asked people for suggestions too.
We
right?
did, yes.
Yeah. So the tied winner, is it currently tied?
Yes, it's currently tied.
So this book was ahead, but now it is tied, but it is now, we're recording this episode, so this is the next one. It's going to be Barn 8 by Deb Olin Unferth. And you can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
And probably after that, we will be reading Luster by Raven Leilani. So Leilani, I don't have the name right in front of me. But anyway, you can check that out too if you want. I know some of you have actually read it. So looking forward to it. The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becky Young and Corinne Keener, with technical and production support provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye. Bye.
Special thanks to Brilliant Books in Traverse City this week, because The Old Drift was one of the books that they chose to send us for our Brilliant Books monthly subscription, and they were spot on with the pick. We're obviously thrilled with it. You can check out Brilliant Books at brilliant-books.net. Check out their Brilliant Books monthly subscription. They seriously rule at picking books that you'll love just based off of some things you like. That you let them know about. Can't recommend it highly enough. So thank you again.